Well, good morning, folks. My name is Jack Spirko, host of a show called The Survival Podcast. We've been running for 14 and a half years. We'll celebrate our 15th anniversary in June of this year. And you can learn more about us at thesurvivalpodcast.com. A little bit about this presentation. This presentation is called Food Security is the First Security. I decided to use that title because I've been to parts of the world where there is no food security. And I can tell you for a fact, when food security goes away, so does all the other forms of security. If you're in a part of the world where you're kind of afraid to walk down the street without a couple of armed guards with you, I promise you that there's people in that area who are concerned about whether or not their children will eat tomorrow. And I would bet you the vast majority of people listening to this, you ascribe to what we call the non-aggression principle. You have stated, I will not harm or use force against another individual, no matter what, unless I am defending myself from them, unless they use force first, right? How many people agree with that? Put your hand up. Yeah, tons of you guys. Yeah, what if your kid wasn't going to eat tomorrow or the next day or the next day? And what if you could already see your kid's ribs sticking out through the skin and you were afraid if they didn't eat by next week, they would die? Might you violate that principle? And you are a highly principled person. You have made that statement from the get-go. Most people haven't. So imagine what happens to an area when food security falls apart. All the other forms of security fall apart. And once security falls apart, then what do you have? You have the ability for a state or a body of governance like the WEF to come in and say, hey, I've got a solution for you. And people, when they're scared, they take deals and they make bad deals with the devil, like Satan Schwab himself. That's what we're here to avoid, right? With the Greater Reset. So let's talk about how we can make sure that we can secure food for ourselves and our families and our communities going forward. And if we can do that, well, we might just be okay. I also want to let you know, you should write down a URL right now, thesurvivalpodcast.com/greater4, greater the number 4, greater 4. Tons of resources, tons of additional information. It's all free, is available for you at that URL. Moving forward, also remember, why are we here? Just to stop the WF and the Greater Reset? No, we're here because we are tired of being owned and controlled by other people. A little meme here. I made this. Anyone does literally everything. Anything. The government. Give me my share, my piece. We call it taxes. I call it theft. I call it extortion. Well, what I'm going to teach you today is largely not taxed. Like, even if you told them you were doing it, you wouldn't pay tax on it. A lot of it that you might sort of kind of have to pay tax on, there's no way really for them to know to make you pay tax on it. The other thing is, the way we really win this is we build this parallel economy that we're talking about. So while so many people come to events like this to see and meet speakers, and guys, I will talk to you. You want to ask me questions, come up to me. You're not bothering me. That's why I'm here. Come see me. Ask me questions. Talk to me. Get to know me. I want to get to know you. But look at all these other people around you that have common ideals. Make sure you're talking to people. Write down their names, their email, their phone number if they're willing to give it to you, Telegram handle, Twitter handle, whatever it is, and something about them, what they're looking to learn about, and what they know about. That way you'll remember them. Write down characteristics too. Wear a stupid hat, right? You know, he was a jerk. That's me, in case you're wondering. Right? And that way when you communicate with them down the road, you'll remember who they are. Start building out these relationships. Without that, we don't have anything. Also, I want to tell you that, you know, a lot of times when people start thinking about growing their own food and all, they think about kind of living like a peasant. Does this look like peasant food? I guess it kind of is. I grew everything in these two pictures on my property except the cocktails made by my buddy David, the booze whisperer. But the salads, the wildflowers, the nasturtiums, everything that's in this, the chicken, all of this was grown on my property. It's a Jamaican jerk chicken salad. It has a variety of greens with it, including spinaches and lettuces, like romaine lettuces, lamb's quarters. The purple flowers are from a plant called spiderwort. It's a wildflower that grows on my property. There's little blossoms from wild garlic. There are black locust blossoms in there. The other picture is a big old nasturtium leaf with nasturtium flower, some baby lamb's quarter leaf, some fennel fronds, some chives. This is a normal day for me. Especially in the spring and early summer before it gets hot out. I eat like this all the time, and I want to teach you how to do it as well. So in a minute, I'll explain to you kind of how we're going to come at this. But I want to start out with more. Why are we doing this? Why did I pick this topic? Why did I call it this? Because we have a big problem. You know, we talked about Klaus Schwab and the WEF and the government and all these new regulations and Agenda 2030. A lot of this stuff, it's not that it's not a problem. But talking about it and addressing, we act as though it is the actual problem. When the truth is the people behind these movements are leveraging the real problem to present to you that solution of eating the bugs. Of having somebody control how much electricity you're allowed to use. Taking away your gas stove, whatever it is. Ain't happening for me. But if we're going to say that, then we have to stop thinking the only thing we're doing is fighting them. If they were gone, it would all be okay. It wouldn't. We have a real problem. We have a bunch of problems. Tremendously large problems. Number one, our biggest export in this country is topsoil. Whenever I say that, a lot of people are like, huh? What? I didn't know that. And they start imagining like giant barges of topsoil being shipped to like the Sudan or something. That's not how it gets out of here. We don't get any money for it. We don't sell it. We don't mine it. Kind of do. It's really kind of a strip mining operation called agriculture. But the wind and the erosion and the rain and the runoff and the lack of riparian areas take our topsoil up into the wind and out to sea. Or up in the wind and then down into lakes and rivers and streams where they go out to sea. We have a dead zone bigger than the state of frickin' Delaware every year at the mouth of the Mississippi River where it goes into the Gulf of Mexico, where everything dies. But we're also stripping the land, which is leading to a declining fertility. That's right, we have declining fertility, and that means that we're able to grow less every year on the same land. So we mine more minerals in the forms of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium and keep saturating the ground with this fertility. But even the fertility we're adding becomes less and less bioavailable every year, and we go into then declining biodiversity. That's not just the different plant species and animal species, but the fungal species in the soil, the bacterial species in the soil, the aerobic bacteria, the things that allow plants to communicate with each other and to access nutrients in decline. That picture on this page, that's one of my gardens. It's about a 4x8 part of my garden. There's 25 different varieties of edible plants in that one little spot. If I can tuck 25 varieties of edible plants into a 4x8 raised bed, imagine what we can tuck into 40 acres if we do it right. The big thing, though, we're also at a massive decline in health in the human species. You understand that? Like, people are sicker today than ever before. There's more dialysis clinics today in some towns than there are fast food restaurants, though I do think there's a connection. You know the number one reason for those dialysis clinics? Type 2 diabetes and kidney failure. It's an entire industry. It's a multi-billion dollar industry. Is the health of our people decline? Today, a child who's 15 years old can expect to live less years than his parents and grandparents. For the first time in America, a generation can expect to live less than the prior generation. And what has all this led to? A 12-to-1 to the negative energy ratio. It takes about 1 million calories to feed the average person in America today. That's overeating. It's 2,800 calories, but it's average. That's part of why we're so fat. But it's 12-to-1 to the negative. It takes about 12 million calories of oil and gas, oil and diesel energy to produce 1 million calories of food. It's the very definition of a system that is not sustainable. More goes in than comes out. The big thing is there's no excuse for any of it. None. We have solutions to all these problems. In the words of Bill Mollison, while the problems that we have are increasingly complex, the solutions are embarrassingly simple. What are we going to cover today? Calorie crops and nutrient flavor crops. We're going to start with the core bean gardening because it's the easiest step for most people to take, and it should be the core. I don't care what you're doing. I don't care if you have a 40-acre homestead and you're grazing cattle and sheep and turkeys or pigs or whatever, great. You should still have a zone one. We teach that in permaculture. We're going to talk about small livestock because it's the number one nutrient density play that we have. Whether it's eating the animals themselves or their byproducts, like eating the flesh of an animal, yes. Or eating the product of an animal, like an egg. There's nothing we can do for nutrient density for ourselves that equates with one little piece of liver or one really great pasture-raised egg. There really isn't. But the nutrient density also comes from the fertility gain that we get from these small livestock. So we're going to talk about fertility. And yes, I'm going to give you a meat trigger warning. I heard a little gasp. Heard a little gasp there when I said eat the animals, because I know there are a significant numbers of vegans and vegetarians in this audience. That's okay. And so I'm going to let you know there's two slides in particular that will show cuts of meat, and not an animal being slaughtered. It's what you'd see in a grocery store, but I want you to know that so you don't get mad at me. I'll let you know when they're coming, and that way if you want to turn away or maybe just skip this presentation, you can, because I can't really do this presentation justice without letting you know exactly what it is that we're trying to produce. Let's start off with some gardening stuff. I broke this into two categories for you. I just want to give you some of the plants that I grow. I'm doing this because I believe when you leave a presentation, you should have written down a few things that you go, I can go do that. And everybody can garden. Everybody can garden. You can garden on a patio. And if you learn one new crop that you can grow that makes your life better, then it was worth the 45 minutes you sat here with me today. The first item I have is a calorie crop, squash, and specifically winter squash in the family of C. moschetta. This squash is the most resistant to the squash vine borer, which is the number one demonic satanic pest of squash. Anywhere, but specifically in the southern United States. They are awful critters. They get in the vine, they kill it, and then the whole plant dies. Well, these guys, I have had them invade it, and they survive. I've had them not invade it because the core is so dense. It's not really what they want to eat. And my favorite variety is the Trumbuscino zucchini, which is in that picture right there. That one's about 4 feet long. It hasn't even hardened off and turned orange yet. That means it can be used as a summer squash where it's not really yet developed a lot of its calories and its sugars. So it's more of a summer squash, a low caloric plant. So I use it that way. But it can definitely be stored long term as a winter squash by letting it cure off like the one that I have here in my hand. This squash was harvested in September. It's now mid-January. I did nothing to it. It's been sitting on the floor in my office. And I have a bunch more of them. So the beauty of the storage capacity of this particular product is it's high in calories relative to what it is. It is highly pest resistant. It can feed you very well. You can grow a ton of it in this climate. If you plant, 20 of these plants, you'll have it coming out of your ears, and it's all flesh except for the bulb. So that big long neck, every bit of that is edible. There's nothing to do with it except cut it and maybe peel it and roast it or do whatever you want to with it. Real quick, going through some of my other top caloric crops for this climate. Sweet potato, way more reliable in the southern climates than conventional potatoes. Totally different species. Also, the greens are edible. I grow mine mainly for the greens. We eat a few every year as a treat from the tubers. We save them to grow more. But mainly, I grow the greens to feed my livestock. And I'll feed my ducks a wheelbarrow load of sweet potato greens every 2 or 3 days and never run out of them all summer long. Jerusalem artichoke, the most productive crop by far with the least amount of pest problems and everything else that I've ever found. The first year I grew Jerusalem artichoke, somebody sent me some. I took two of them. I cut them into 4 pieces each, so 8 pieces. I put them in a 4-foot by 10-foot bed, and I got 5 5-gallon buckets. 25 gallons of artichoke out of them. Gave them away, ate them. They taste fantastic. Wonderful plant, definitely calorically dense. Store really well in cold storage as long as they're kept a little bit damp. So Ziploc bag, crumbled up, damp paper towel per 1 gallon Ziploc bag. They'll store for all the way until next season. Turnips and beets are a great winter crop. You get a green and you get a root crop, a calorie crop. Shelling beans are also a great crop in our climate. Winter peas, I really recommend you check out a variety of winter pea called Blaze Winter Pea. This winter pea survived the great freeze of 2020 here in Texas. A lake, 60,000 plus acre lake, a few miles from my house, froze over. People walked on it. Never happens. One man in my neighborhood was old enough to remember it ever happening before. And the only one I could find that ever remembered it happening before. And Blaze Winter Pea survived that. We had like a 9-day straight where we had most of our temps were single digit. Our highest highs in that period of time were in the mid-teens. And we had lows below zero. and this plant survived. So it's definitely worth checking out. And remember, with peas, you can eat the peas, but you can also eat the little pods before they're mature. You can shell the peas as a storage crop. You can eat the pea tendrils and even the little pea leaves. All of it is delicious. And then cow pea, which isn't really a pea, one of the most sustainable. It's a crop that builds fertility in the soil of nitrogen, loves southern climates. It's an amazing plant, and it helped keep a lot of people alive in the South during the Civil War, because as the North began its invasion and began burning fields to starve out the South, to choke them off so they would surrender, the Northern troops didn't burn the fields with the cowpeas in it. They didn't even recognize it as food. I have never really had a pest problem with cowpea ever, and I grow it again mainly as a crop for my livestock. Moving on, though, I also want to talk a little bit about some other plants that I grow. I call these flavor-enhancing crops, lifestyle-enhancing crops. These are things that don't really provide you with a ton of calories, but they make all your other food better. So people like me that eat mostly meat, this is something to go with it, right? And for people that are going to be growing a lot of calorically dense crops and you want to expand on that and make them taste better, these are some of the things you can grow. The number one thing I wanted to give you today in this group of plants is a plant called python snake bean. This is actually a gourd. It is incredibly versatile. I cooked some for my students in my fall workshop. They ate it like you would have thought I put filet mignon with lobster down or something, the way that they devoured this stuff. Even Ken Berry, the carnivore himself, said, man, that's damn good. It tastes a little bit like cucumber, and it tastes a little bit like green bean. And if you eat it raw, it tastes more like cucumber, and if you cook it, it tastes more like green bean. When I cooked it for my folks, I split them open, took the pulp out. The pulp can actually be used when it's mature as a tomato paste substitute. Harvested the seed, let the guys play with the tomato paste, took the outside parts, and no matter how big it doesn't get woody and stemmy. It doesn't get where you can't eat it anymore. It doesn't get pithy. Diced it up, threw it on the grill with some olive oil, Redmond salt, cooked it till it was just a little, still a little bit of tooth to it, and people killed it. And again, it tastes kind of like green bean, but in a different way. It's a delicious crop. It's extremely resistant to pests. Amazing one to check out. Loves the heat of our climate. Lettuces and greens are more of a temperate climate, or I grow them indoors in hydro and aquaponics. Mainly, I grow romaine lettuces and arugula for my primary greens. In the summer, I also rely on a lot of greens that can even go perennial in our climate, like New Zealand spinach. Beans, Asian long beans are my favorite. I like the Chinese red noodle variety. I like them because it's easy to spot the beans in the giant wall of green vines. They're also a crop that you can easily harvest seed for over and over and over again. And most of the plants that I'm giving you are. So you don't rely on a seed store. You can just save seed every year and keep growing them. Cucumber. I have found Asian variety cucumbers. And I haven't really noticed much of one being better than the other. But Asian variety cucumbers, most resistant to the primary disease that we have in our gardening here in Texas for cucumbers, which is cucumber mosaic virus. Fennel, Florence, good old school heirloom Florence fennel, bulb fennel. I love that. I grow a ton of it every year. I harvest about half. I leave the other half to the butterflies and to go to seed. The black swallowtails, their caterpillars love it. And what I've noticed is if those ones that I let kind of go to seed let go too long, what ends up happening is three or four new smaller bulbs sprout off the side, and I get a second harvest in the fall if I don't try to wait for those secondary bulbs to get really big. If I'll go ahead and take them small, I can get two harvests, and the loss that I've kind of dedicated and sacrificed to the butterflies is more than paid back in the little bulbs that I pick up from there, and the seed harvest. Peppers, primary chilies and sweet peppers. I grow mostly jalapeno, Thai chilies, and poblanos for the hot peppers. Those are fantastic. I do a lot of surf fishing, so the poblanos go great with a ceviche, which is just fish cured with lime juice instead of being cooked, which is the highest use of many saltwater fish, in my opinion. And I grow California bell, a variety of colors, just for that pop of color and that hit. And the other thing that I grow is a pepper called Cubanelle, which is a fantastic pepper. And it's almost like two peppers in one. It's more tastes like a banana pepper in the light green stage. When you let it mature, it's way sweeter than any bell pepper. And it looks beautiful in dishes like the ones I showed you earlier. Tomatoes, I found that cherry tomatoes do best in Texas. I generally grow like maybe one large variety. Celebrity's done okay for me. But Matt's Wild Cherry, Texas Wild Cherry, Sweet 100, those have have done great for me. Hack on your tomatoes. When you start your tomatoes, put 3 aspirin tablets in your little cup that you start your seed in. When you plant that started tomato out in your garden, put 3 aspirin tablets in the hole. And once a month through the season, put 3 aspirin tablets around the base of the tomato and water in like they're fertilizer spikes. I used to give up on my tomatoes midsummer every year. I'd get as many as I could, and then the blight would come. This year, I harvested tomatoes up to the frost. My students cut down my tomato plants when we did a chop and drop in my garden. Eggplant, Asian varieties, to me, they're much more flavorful. They don't require salting and bledding to make them palatable. You can take them right off the vine and cook with them. They absorb flavor like a sponge. They're great for the carnivore who wants to add something to the meal, right, besides just straight carnivore. And they're great for the vegetarian or the vegan or primarily plant-based and small amount of meat for the same reason, because they suck up that flavor and they're a relatively low-carbohydrate plant to begin with. And they have a lot of nutrient, even though they don't have a lot of calories. And then herbs, all of them. We should all be growing all the herbs that we can. This is where I want to turn the corner. I want to talk about small livestock. And, you know, trigger warning here, yeah, we're looking at some dead animal. And I have the animals ranked not in my recommendation as far as which ones are best, because you're going to find that each of these has an advantage for different people in different situations. I have them ranked in order here based on how good they are at feeding themselves and how well you can use that advantage to reduce your dependence on the feed store. So I think for a lot of people, the best option is the first one, even though it's the least able to feed itself. And that's the common Japanese quail or Kortnik's quail. That's what you're looking at there. That's the livers, the heart, and the core of the quail. There's 11 of them there. I timed myself. I went from having the quail in a small cage, ready to process them, to rinsing them off, all of that, getting to the point you're looking at in that slide in 30 minutes, and I was not in a hurry. I used shears, cut the backbone out. It's kind of an involved process to explain, but it takes around a minute a bird to actually process a bird and get it nice and clean like that. I always save the livers from them. Quail livers are decent, but I generally use the quail livers in other sausages. I generally use my organ meats and sausages. The hearts are delicious sauteed, a little salt and pepper, some jalapenos, eat them with toothpicks, fantastic. And look at the dark, almost purple-like quality of that meat. If you buy quail from a market, it won't look like that. Those quail were raised in an aviary. They had access to greens and things like that, so you can feed them some, but they're going to require more than any other animal in this list to be fed supplemental feed that you're going to have to buy in. They really are. But you know what? They have a huge ROI on that. They're incredibly efficient in production. A quail, when it hatches out of the egg in 6 weeks, is about the size that you're looking at and ready to be processed. At 7 weeks, they start laying new eggs. So they're definitely a good way to go. I knew one gentleman that kept a single stack of quail cages in his garage, and he produced several thousand meat quail a year by culling all of his males and then culling out females as he wanted more for egg production. Moving on, chickens, I really recommend you check out the American Breast Chicken Group on Telegram, and you'll find that on that link that I gave you. Don't worry, I'll give you a way to write it down again. But chickens in general, I'm not going to say a lot because everybody knows that chickens are one of the favorite backyard livestock. Most people get them for eggs. Our parents use the regular old chickens that we keep in our backyards for meat. We've been sold a lie that we need these special hybrid chickens or whatever. We don't. I know a lot of people in Texas, their philosophy is I raise chickens and I eat roosters. And if that rooster takes 14, 16 weeks to be large enough to be where you really want to cull it out, it's not that big a deal when you're not trying to make a money, when you're not working for Tyson. Ducks. Ducks are my favorite backyard poultry as far as the quality of an egg. There is nothing quite like a over-medium duck egg on top of a salad or on top of a steak or on top of some asparagus. All of those are fantastic. The Muscovy duck is going to give you almost as many eggs. People think they lay six, but they lay all their eggs from like January to June. They'll give you like 120 eggs in that period. So the big deal with Muscovies, if you're really relying on them for eggs, then you really want to make sure you have a way to preserve eggs, whether you're freezing them, dehydrating them, what have you. or you're selling them for a financial, so they have a financial battery, we can exchange them for other food down the road with other folks. They also, though, are far better foragers than mallard breed ducks, which all the other ducks are. And so they're definitely worth taking a look at, because they also can live almost entirely, if you have good grass and all those insects that are running around your property, if you have enough land relative to your ducks, they can grow almost entirely on grass. I'll throw a little extra one in here. Geese can go 100% on grass. The big thing with Muscovies is they are a wild bird. They are domesticated in that we have conditioned them to stay put, to live with us. A Muscovy that you would buy from a local homesteader today, though, won't look, act, or be very different from one that you would find in the wilds of Mexico or northern Central America today that still lives in the wild. It's a wild-form bird. About the only thing we've done to domesticate them is play around with their color. They're about the same size, same attitude. Be careful messing with them, man. The claws of a Muscovy will plumb open you up like a razor blade. And they are way stronger than a typical that you would think by looking at their size. Next on that scale, right, of how much do I have to buy in for my animals, rabbits, it is 100% possible to feed rabbits 100% from your own land, even if you had a half of an acre. What you need is a really good lawn. It's really more like a backyard pasture. A good mix of perennial grasses, forbs, clovers, and things like that. And a bag lawnmower. And you mow your lawn and you feed your bunnies. And you don't mow the whole lawn at once. You mow enough to feed your bunnies for a couple days. And then you mow a little bit more. And when you have to mow the whole lawn, you do. So what do you do about winter and shortages and stuff? You go on YouTube and you search mini bale maker. And with some plywood and some other materials, you make a little mini straw bale maker, a little hay bale maker, and you make hay out of your own lawn, and that alone would probably feed your rabbits. Now, you go ahead and you plant yourself some fodder trees like hybrid mulberry, hybrid willow, and hybrid poplar, and you start coppicing, which means you cut the trees and let them grow back every year, and you feed the small stems and leaves to your bunnies, and you can even make basically silage or hay out of those things. I would still recommend that you have some rabbit pellets to make sure that nothing goes wrong, but you could easily buy very cheaply 3 months of rabbit pellets for a group of rabbits that can produce a ton for you, and if you're doing things the way I said, that's going to easily go a year. So buying 3 months of food and getting a year's supply without working that hard for it, that makes rabbits really sustainable. How inexpensively can you run rabbits? I have friends, John Willis from SOE Tactical Gear for one, Nick Ferguson is another, that run larger livestock operations, sheep and maybe cattle, who knows what, right? And so they have livestock guardian dogs. We have to feed those dogs. They feed their dogs almost 100% off rabbits that they grow, and they grow the rabbits almost 100% off vegetation from their property. So they feed their dogs for free. Big, huge rabbits. The other thing is rabbits are a monetary yield crop. The most money you will ever make with a rabbit is not processing a rabbit and selling it for food. It's selling a live rabbit to somebody else who wants to grow rabbits. Way more profitable that way. Last one I have for you is sheep. And I include sheep because they're like rabbits that move around and they have a much larger yield. And if you want to learn more about sheep, I would definitely recommend what we call hair sheep. You don't have to shear them, in other words. They take care of that themselves. They basically shed their wool because the wool is not worth as much as it costs to remove. And the guy I would recommend you learn more about that from is a guy named Greg Judy. He's like the sheep whisperer, right? He has a great interview. It's over an hour long. He did with Justin Rhodes. I have a link in that resource page that I gave you where you can watch that and you can learn more from that 1 hour than most people that keep sheep today know. But the big reason I like a sheep, I have a little knife here. You guys in the back row can probably barely see it. I can break down a deer 100% from I shot the deer, it hit the forest floor with this knife. I usually use a saw for a few things to make things easier, but I could do it with just a knife. I could certainly do it with a knife and a hacksaw. No problem. And I mean make full use of that animal. If I want to be really spoiled, I'll have a gambrel. That's a little thing that goes between the animal's legs that we can hoist it up in the air and hang it so that we can easily process it. I don't even need that. A couple pieces of rope and a tree branch. and all by myself, in well under an hour, I can process a deer. And you can learn to do that too. What does that have to do with a sheep? They're about the same size. You process them the same way. You can by yourself process a sheep in an hour. When I process a deer, I can go, if you take the totality of everything, breaking it down into quarters, letting it age a bit in the refrigerator, let that meat harden up and age, then breaking down the primal cuts into smaller cuts, boning out certain portions of it, grind it, like the whole thing, 4 hours, drinking some beer, watching the Outdoor Channel on television. Yeah? You can do the same thing with a sheep. Try that with a cow. Try that with a cow. So that's why I included sheep here. I got one more bonus animal for you, but I ain't going to tell you what it is. I want to ask you what you think it is. If you know, because you remember when I posted this picture, don't tell anybody. But if you don't know, shout out. What do you think that is? Does it look like pork? The number one answer I've gotten to that question, it's pork. It looks like maybe a smaller, like a feral hog, like the upper shoulder from above that's been cut. It's turkey. That's a turkey back. The broad-breasted bronze turkey is the easiest meat that I've ever raised, and it's paid for itself, even buying feed. What I did 1 year, I got 12 of them. I sold 9, and I didn't do any work for the ones I sold. People came to my place, they picked their turkey, they took it away. They self-processed it, or they took it to a butcher, either or, I didn't care. When it was done, they weighed it, and on the honor system, they paid me by the pound on the weight of the processed bird. And I paid for every bit of feed they ate and more that way, and I got to keep 3. And I ended up, and this is not counting bones, because I boned out the breast on these dadgone things. I ended up with 75 pounds of meat for free, even though I bought the feed. That's pretty sustainable because you're using other people's money. We're not, it's not only the people that are the power elite that can play that game. I actually brought value to the table, though. I provided that's the back, by the way. That's the half of the back of a back of a turkey. That's the part most people throw away or they make stock out of. That's a meal and a half right there. And it is incredibly beautiful looking meat if you take a look at it. That's the last of the meat picture. Let's talk about fertility here as we get toward winding up. I talked about the problems that we have in America today with degradation of our biodiversity, our topsoil, everything else. And it all has to do with the fact that we have decided that we will mine fertility from mineral deposits and pouring acid on rocks. And all we need is NPK, and we'll just throw it in the soil, and then we can abuse the soil, and then we lose everything, including the biology in the soil that makes the rest of the fertility, the nutrients, the micronutrients, etc., the minerals available to the plants. I can sum up how to manage fertility in 3 phrases. Build fertility, hold fertility, increase fertility. So most likely when you get onto a piece of land in the beginning, it's not going to be very fertile unless it was under a good management program. So you're going to have to initially build fertility. So that's going to be with composting, running animals, etc., and maybe even bringing in some material depending on what you have available to you. Maybe even bringing in some organic compost organic fertilizer. Dr. Earth is one of the best products out there for that. Bringing in fertilizers that are built on maybe poultry manure or something to get things started. I love working with nature, but we've got to give nature something to work with. Hold fertility. So we need strategies to keep the fertility from leaching away and then increase fertility. So we need to be running a system that our soil should look better and test better every single year. You do that and you are not infinitely sustainable. You're infinitely regenerative. Start by building what wasn't there. Hold that fertility and increase it every year. And one of my primary methods I do that with is my method of composting, which is based on a method called Johnson-Suh bioreactors. All right, Johnson-Suh bioreactor. I've massively shortened it down. My composting method is dead simple. I have a pit just to the right of my duck coop that you can see there in the background in that picture. In that pit goes every bit of waste that I have that ducks and chickens will process or will not hurt them. A potato peel, fine. The kids wanted strawberries again, and my wife bought them, and they only ate half of them, and now they're rotted. Fine. Eggshells, fine. Coffee grinds, fine. And all of the aquatic plants I won't get into today, but I grow aquatic plants. I grow plants like water hyacinth and azolla for my ducks. And I throw those in the pit too, and I let them eat those there. That goes on for a year. Inside my coop, I use a mixture of wood chips and straw to keep the stink down. And I lay down a layer, and then the ducks go in there, and the chickens go in there every night, and they poop. And after a few weeks, maybe a month, depending on the season and our head count, it starts to smell a little bit, so I put down another layer. And then another month or two later, another layer, and I keep doing that. And by the end of the year, I have about a foot deep of deep litter in there. I put it all into big rings of ghost fence like this with some pipes in it. I get it really, really soaking wet. This is all described on my YouTube channel where you can see the details of how to do it. And I don't do nothing. I just keep it wet. I put a sprinkler on it, run the sprinkler for a minute a day until it's done breaking down. There's a little more to it than that, but that's basically it. And I make the best compost you've ever seen in your life. When you soak it wet, it rolls up like clay. When it dries, it gets into a crumble. And even when it looks like clay, you can still crumble it and you can push it back together into a clay. Anybody that's looked at it under a microscope has been blown away. It's massively fungal. And it's no work. This year I got my students to do it for me. Last year I did it myself. It took me about 6 hours of work. 6 hours of work, a year's worth of compost from a byproduct, and just a simple solution. I make about 3 of those a year that you see right there. And again, I never turn it. And it takes about 2 to 2.5 months to be ready. It's not as ready as a fast turn, but it's a much better product. It is amazing what it'll do. You have a plant that's looking a little sick. You make a couple little BB balls of it with some moisture. Make some holes and put it around there and water it in. You watch that plant turn around. And I've also started to work with biochar. So biochar is where we burn woody material into charcoal and we put that into our soil. And we take that from something called terra preta, which we have not cracked the code on exactly how the Native Americans of the Amazon rainforest made this stuff. But there is soil that was made 1,000 years ago or more that's still fertile today that nobody's done anything with since it was made. And it's composed of biochar. It's composed of shards of pottery, basically shards of clay pottery, and other nutrient and bacteria and fungi that we don't even understand. And these people made this thousands of years ago. And there's a whole war on this. I see people are a couple people here and they're a little uncomfortable because there's been all this FUD that we're going to burn down the whole planet to make biochar and justify it with that. We'll get to that with tactics and technique at the end. Now, I make biochar with prunings from trees that I compost every year for fodder and for other needs and for firewood and what have you. They're all trees I planted. They wouldn't even be there if I hadn't planted them. I'll show you what a difference the land looks like in my last slide. It's pretty amazing. And it does no harm. And it has to do with how we do this. Now, what the natives did, they did a cool burn. And a lot of what they were burning wasn't necessarily trees. It was understory and herbaceous plants and things like that. It was done over, dozens, if not hundreds, if thousands of years that this soil was built up. They estimate that under the practices that were being done, it grew at about 1 centimeter a year. And there's some places it's 6 foot deep. But that's regenerative. That's infinitely sustainable. And we can make something very close to that with terra preta. And we can do that. Remember I talked about fodder trees for certain livestock? Well, when we use fodder, we cut these trees either down at the bottom, we call that a compost, to the ground, or we cut them up high and we let them sprout out from up high, maybe about shoulder height, depending on what our goals are. And we feed that then to a ruminant, or another, a rabbit, or a goat, or a sheep, or a cow. But then some of those stems will be pretty big, like wrist size thick in 1 year. Once you establish fodder trees, these trees grow really, really fast. Well, they don't want that. We can use the bigger pieces for firewood and fuel cooking wood, and the smaller pieces that are intermediate, we can put them into a simple kiln, we can burn them, we can extinguish that fire and let them turn into charcoal. We can crush them up and add them to soil. Now, the tests that have been done to disprove this It's scientifically disingenuous. Gee, imagine that, stacking the deck of a study. So what they did is they took one area and they just fertilized it with conventional fertilizer. They took another area and they did like an organic fertilizer like chicken poop. And they did another one and they used charcoal. And they said, look, the worst performing one was the charcoal. And they quit. Now it's not worth it. Well, the people that did it the right way mixed the chicken poop in the charcoal and it outproduced everything. Because the purpose of the biochar in the terra preta and the shards of ceramics, which I don't know how we quite replicate that, is not to provide nutrient, it's to hold it. What did I say? Build, hold, increase. So if we have something that holds it like a magnet and doesn't let go of it, like char, just charcoal has massive numbers, it's huge amount of surface area, little holes, little apartments for microorganisms to live in, and it grabs on and it makes that stuff, think of it as making it sticky, it can't get away. And if we combine that, so instead of isolating these things into unitarian things, which we seem to love to do in our world, if we move that into, and we start adding things like silvopasture and grazing systems with this, what we can do to recharge our soils should blow our minds away. Silvopasture is where we have grazing lanes and trees, and then the animals graze and the trees may be mash trees that feed the animals or feed humans. We can also grow fodder trees in there, and all of that waste can be turned into biochar and used to increase the fertility in the pasture. Just as one option. Just as one option. And this is infinitely sustainable. And with ruminants, we can restore broad-scale ecosystems. We can convert these 80,000, 100,000 acre or more fields of one grain, canola, wheat, corn. We can convert them to diverse ecosystems supporting thousands of different species of animals, thousands of different species of fungi and bacteria, thousands of different species of plants, where we stop seeing the deer is an enemy to be killed because it ate our corn. The deer is just another ruminant in the system. It's fine. It nibbles on the fodder tree. So what? We make the browse level high enough that we bring it down when we want to. That's what we could be doing. And this all comes down to something I think is one of the most important things to understand about this stuff when we talk about tactics and techniques. Biochar is a tactic, is a technique. Biochar is a technique. Silvopasture is a technique. Grazing systems are techniques. Composting is a technique. Tactics is the way that we implement it. So the FUD around the biochar thing is they'll use it as an excuse to burn down the forest. There's nothing they won't use as an excuse to burn shit down. It is the technique that is implemented that is everything. My final thoughts for you guys. Find your heroes and do something. Back in 2008, I started my podcast. Somewhere there about the beginning, I heard about permaculture and I thought I didn't know anything, right? So by 2009, I didn't know anything about permaculture. I was a permaculture idiot. I thought permaculture was you grew trees instead of corn. I had no idea. A lot of the stuff I talked to you about today was all within the permaculture wardrobe. No idea. Somebody sent me a video of Jeff Lawton called Greening the Desert, the first one. Terribly done. Beautiful results, though. And it opened my mind. I was like, oh my God, this guy did this in Jordan? In the Dead Sea Valley? He grew figs? He made mushrooms show up where nobody knew what a mushroom was? And he did it by putting some ditches in the ground on a thing called contour and a little bit of drip irrigation and some mulch? I got no room to bitch about how hard it is to garden in Texas. And I was like, I want to be like him. And then I learned about Bill Mollison. I learned about people like Alan Savory and Mark Shepard and Joel Salatin, and all these huge names in permaculture. I started studying everything that I could that they did, and I was like, I want to be more like them. I want to be more like them. And this picture is the property I'm on now in 2014, about a year after we moved in. I did a class. I had some students there, some swales put in, and we mulched it. We hadn't even planted any trees yet, and I have that picture there to show you what it looked like in 2014. Before I show you what it looked like by 2018, less than 4 years later, because this was winter, and then the picture I'm going to show you is in the spring. By 2014, I had done enough with permaculture that those people that were my heroes, there was a conference called Permaculture Voices, Greg Judy spoke at it. Jeff Lawton spoke at it. Alan Savely spoke at it. Joel Salatin spoke at it. All of my heroes spoke at that conference. I shared the stage with them. And I'm not saying that to brag. I believe that you find heroes in the way that you seek out people who do the things you want to do, and that teaches you you can do those things too. There's a song from the movie 8 Seconds by Billy Dean called That's Why We Call Them Heroes. There's a line in it, and that's what it says. They point to the best in us all and say, if I can, you can too. That's what these men did for me, and all I did was emulate them and pour myself into it. Whether it's permaculture, whether it's agriculture, whether it's grazing, some piece of this, whether it's in tech, right? Whether it's in economics, whether it's in building structures, I don't care what it is. The thing that you want to do, the only thing preventing you from being alongside those heroes you should seek out is yourself. I went from idolizing these people to standing beside them on the stage in 3 years because I dedicated myself to something that I believe would change the world. And what I want to show you now is how I changed my little piece of the world. That picture, 4 years later, standing in the exact same spot. The prior picture, you can see across the street to my neighbor's property. That's what that white fence straight ahead in that distance is. In this picture, you can't even see the street. There's hundreds of species in there. And it all was done with the simple principles I learned from these people. I couldn't cover everything today. I couldn't even scratch the surface. If you want to know more, again, you can find everything that backs up what I talk about, everything that takes you to the next level, everything that helps you find your peace that you want to pursue at thesurvivalpodcast.com/greater4.